So will you welcome with me Jeff Ladislav here?
You know, I was speaking at a church once a few years ago, and there was a couple there celebrating their 75th wedding anniversary. I thought, oh my, I mean, that's where it's at. You know, I can't wait till my wife and I reach that point. So, well, to answer a couple of questions, Dick, I actually went to the University of Alaska on a shooting scholarship. So that's why. Yeah. And then it's interesting, my daughter is the youngest member of the House of Representatives, and it's ironic because I spent 2 weeks trying to talk her out of running for office. I said, you do not want to do this. This is, you know, it's a dog-eat-dog world up there, and she knows that. She's served as the staffer for the Senate Judiciary Committee for two sessions, so she understood what she was getting into, but I really did try to talk her out of it. Well, it's my pleasure to be with you today. There's two things that make me want to be here today. The first of all, I love talking to groups of people with whom I agree, because I spend a lot of time talking to groups of people that I don't agree with necessarily. And so I like that. The second thing is I am passionate about marriage. Marriage to me is where it's at, it's the linchpin. I have a great marriage. I was fortunate enough, which is interesting because I asked my wife to marry me 8 weeks after our first date. So it was a fairly quick marriage. I mean, it happened fairly quickly, and it was God ordained, and I love my wife and to death. So anyway, what I want to do today is I've been asked to talk about basically the nexus between marriage and public policy and how the two work together and the interplay between the two and how that builds into the bigger question of society and where society goes. I need to give a couple of disclaimers before I begin. First of all, I'm going to take kind of a 30,000-foot level view of this. I realize there are life experiences that we all go through that affect just about everything I'm going to say, and I'm going to talk in broad generalities. And so please, if I offend you, please know that that is not my intention. I know that people have gone through hard times. I know that marriages don't work out. I understand all of that, and I do realize that I'm treading in some sensitive areas here. But when we talk about public policy, it's hard to get down into the minutia. We have to try to build a society that sort of works for everybody, and everybody's life experience is different. And so please just know that. Also know that I'm going to try to be like that pilot that takes off late. Sorry, folks, but we're going to try to get you to your destination on time. I realize at this point that I am the only person standing between you and lunch, and that is never a good place to be when you're a speaker. The other thing is, if you have some questions, I'd be glad to take them afterwards. In the interest of time, if you ask me a question and my ADD kicks in, we may go down a rabbit trail that I never find myself back from. So anyway, that said, let's go ahead and get started. So I was asked to speak about the government's role in marriage, and we're not going to be talking about the spiritual side, but I really appreciate Pastor Poyer's remarks because they basically teed up what I'm going to talk about. He was talking about things from the broad perspective, and now I'm going to bring them home to Montana, and it's ironic in God's economy and the way things work because the two of us didn't coordinate at all when we put our talks together. I think what I'd like to do is begin with an illustration about a man that was celebrating his 50th anniversary, actually with his wife, and after being married for 50 years, he took a careful look at his wife, and he said, "You know what?" He said, "50 years ago, we had a cheap house, we drove a junk car, we slept on a sofa bed, and we watched TV on a black and white 10-inch TV. And he said, now look where we are 50 years later. He said, we have a $500,000 home, we drive a $35,000 car, we have a really nice big bed, and we sleep, we have a nice big bed, and we watch TV on a big screen TV. He said, the only thing is, when we got married 50 years ago, I got to spend every night sleeping with a hot 23-year-old girl. And he said, you know what? Now I'm looking at you and you're 73. He said, I don't think you're holding up your end of the bargain. Now, his wife was a very reasonable woman. And she thought for a minute and she said, I'll tell you what. She said, you go out and you find yourself a hot 23-year-old girl. And I'll make sure that you're once again living in a cheap house, driving a junk car, sleeping on a sofa bed, watching a 10-inch TV. So, anyway. And I was gonna try and build some big spiritual, you know, tie into what I'm talking about with that. But it was just a good joke and I wanted to tell it, so I threw it in there. Really. All right. So, what we need to do, though, is today we want to talk about government's role in marriage. And the first question, I guess, that we need to ask is, why is government even involved in marriage at all? We understand from our Christian worldview training that marriage is ordained by God, and it's a type of the relationship that Christ has with his bride, the church. And so I understand all that. That's not what we're going to talk about today. What we're going to talk about is why government is involved in marriage relationships. And it's simple. When we come together as a society under a constitution, we're no longer islands unto ourselves. We have what's called a society. And there's within that society, there's three spheres of authority that God created. And you've probably gone over this with your worldview training. There's the sphere of civil government, there's the sphere of the church, and there's the sphere of the family. And there is some overlap between the three. But they're, for the most part, supposed to be autonomous and not tread on each other's ground. When we have a Republican form of government, small r, Republican form of government, that's supposed to be a small government. And it's not supposed to tread into the other two areas. As you move along the scale from this Republican form of government all the way over to full-blown socialism or communism, the sphere of government gets larger and larger until finally the sphere of government almost eclipses the other two. And so what we want in the United States is we want small government. Now, I understand that government tends to overreach, but there is a role, or I would say there is a valid reason why government is involved in marriage. Government has a vested interest in marriage because marriage directly affects the health of society as a whole. That's why government is involved in marriage. Couples that are in solid, committed marriages are physically and mentally healthier, they're wealthier, they live longer, they're happier, and they're more satisfied. Married women are statistically safer in a relationship than women that are cohabitating with a man. These are all legitimate interests for government. Government is not here to make us happy, obviously. That's not the role of government. But as we get into this, we'll see why government has more and more of a vested interest in this. There are other benefits of marriage, however, that accrue to society other than just happiness. People who are healthy and financially secure tend to contribute more to the good of society. They use fewer government services, they pay more in taxes, and they produce offspring that do so as well. And that's key to this. Pastor Poyer touched on that a little bit ago. It's important that we reconnect the concept of marriage and procreation. We've gotten away from that. We've gotten way too far over into the emotional side of this equation. And we need to be brought back, I would argue, for the long-term health of the nation. People who cohabitate and have children out of wedlock tend to use more government services, they pay less in taxes, and they produce offspring that do the same. It's a sad fact, but it's true. Poverty leads to poverty, and the welfare mentality tends to be generational. And now we have some families that are in the fifth generation of welfare and going strong. You know, and the kids are brought up this way, and this is life, this is how it's normally done, this is what they've been modeled, and nothing seems out of place. And it's interesting when some of people with that mentality get elected to the legislature. On the other hand, children who are raised in intact homes with their biological parents, and that's key, with their biological parents, statistically do better by every measure. They're better off mentally and physically. They're better off financially. They tend to be better educated. They have a much lower chance of being abused as children. And they have a much lower likelihood of teen pregnancy, having children out of wedlock, winding up on welfare, or winding up incarcerated. These are all the benefits that accrue to society because of marriage. And so it's pretty easy to make that connection. So let me just drive that point home. Whenever you deviate from the model of kids being raised in an intact family by their biological parents, kids do less well by every measure. It's a statistical fact. It's easy to see why government has a vested interest in marriage as an institution. What we need to remember, though, is that under our system of government, we are the government. Right? So we have a vested interest in marriage as a society, so that we're better off as a society. Intact two-parent homes are generally healthier, so they require fewer government resources in terms of health care. We can think about Medicaid. We can think about Obamacare. We can think about the CHIPS program, the Children's Health Insurance Program here administered by the state of Montana. We can think of specialized help in school. All of these cost money. And so intact two-parent homes are better off financially, so they tend to require fewer government resources in terms of food stamps, subsidized housing, subsidized utilities, subsidized meals at school. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. There are programs out there that you and I haven't even heard of that are available to people that that make less than the norm. Intact two-parent homes tend to produce kids who are more highly educated, and so they tend to get better paying jobs. They tend to wind up paying more in taxes over the course of their lives. Do you see how this whole thing fits together? A solid family tends to produce people that contribute to society. Dysfunctional or single-parent homes or anything that deviates from that model tends to create families and offspring that take from society. I realize that's a broad general statement, but it tends to be true statistically. So government's interest in marriage should be in promoting marriage, promoting healthy marriage, discouraging things like out-of-wedlock births, taking away the disincentives to marriage that occur out there. We can think in terms of welfare and the federal welfare program. To get welfare, a lady has to not be in the same home as the husband of her parents. We're purposely erecting a wall in families. Is that good for kids? We talked about the number of kids being raised in fatherless homes. That exacerbates the problem, I would argue. So government needs to do something to incentivize marriage. And, you know, at this point, now that I've stepped on a bunch of toes probably in here, maybe, I need to tell you that my wife and I were almost there when we got married. It's almost 30 years ago, and we had just moved to Billings. We had just gotten married, and I think we probably got pregnant on our honeymoon. So we were just married and pregnant. And we moved to Billings, and I took a job at the Northern Hotel as a night bellman. And I had just started my own company. And so I was working for myself during the day, working all night at the Northern. And frankly, for a while, we weren't making it. And one day I came home, and here's all this food in the cupboard. And I said, honey, where did all this food come from? And she said, I went to the food bank. And it hit me like a ton of bricks. It crushed me inside. It's embarrassing, but I literally went into the bedroom and cried for a while. I thought, I am not making it as a dad. I have a wife and a baby coming that I'm supposed to be supporting, and I'm not cutting it. And shortly after that, she went down to apply for WIC as well. And this may have been just after Amber was born. But anyway, she went down to apply for WIC. And when she went in there, they said, oh, you qualify for WIC. You know what else you qualify for? And then here the whole thing opens up. You should get this. You should apply for this program. You should apply for this program and this program. And my wife came home to me and she said, you know what, we're not going to do that. And I said, I'm glad, because as a dad, I need to support you guys. And so we didn't. And that was our little run-in with the welfare system. But what it did is it triggered this in my mind. It just showed me how this thing promulgates itself. If you're going through just a little bit of a hard time and you just need this service right here, somehow this thing sucks you in, and all of a sudden you're on all these other programs that you may not have needed to be on. So that's my story. So we've laid the groundwork to show why government has a vested interest in encouraging and strengthening marriage. The question that begs asking is, then why does government seem to be doing everything in its power to cripple marriages? And some people would argue to basically destroy marriage and the concept of marriage. We see this every place for those of us that are involved in public policy. We see it all the time. This is a key phrase that I want you to remember. Policy drives practice. This is really important because there's a lot of things that happen in the state policy-wise that never would have made it through the legislature but are mandated maybe through the courts. And so the legislature says, okay, well, the court says we have to do this, so they implement the policy, and suddenly society finds itself off on a road that the legislature may not have taken it on, or may have, but we need to remember that social mores are broken down by policy. It's the law, so it must be okay. We see this time and time again. And so I want you to remember that. It was interesting that Pastor Poyer talked about no-fault divorce. A few years ago, I had the privilege of spending a couple of days with Michael Reagan, one of President Reagan's children. And let me tell you about him. Michael loves to talk. I mean, he loves to talk. But it was a fascinating experience because I got to learn what it was like growing up Reagan. And I kind of got into the mind of one of the men that I admire most, and that was President Reagan. And at one point in our conversation, I said, Mike, what was your dad's greatest regret in his time as in his public life? And he said, oh, man, that is an easy one. He said this haunted him until the very end. He said the thing that he regretted most was he was the very first governor, when he was governor of California, to implement no-fault divorce. And if you'll remember, that was probably in 67 or 68 when that happened. And then in the 70s, the rest of the state started jumping on board with no-fault divorce. And the divorce curve at first was increasing very slowly, basically flat, but on an incline. And as soon as no-fault divorce hit, that trajectory went exponential, just boom. And that's what I mean by policy drives practice. We have to be very careful what we put our rubber stamp on as policymakers, because society is probably going to head off in that direction. And that's one of the big concerns that we have right now about same-sex marriage and how that plays out in the long term. Another thing that's interesting is some legislators up in Helena and in Congress, frankly, they want to focus on the fiscal issues because that's what government's supposed to do. The most important thing the Montana legislature does when they meet is pass the budget. It's really the only thing they have to do when they meet. That's what they're mandated to do. So these guys say we should just focus on the budget, on the fiscal side of things. We don't want to talk about all that social stuff, abortion, physician-assisted suicide, welfare, I mean, whatever. We don't want to talk about marriage. We don't want to talk about divorce. We just want to focus on the budget. My argument is that it's the social side of the equation that drives the fiscal side. Do you see what entitlements are doing to the budgets, both at the federal and state level? It's incredible. And the problem is that government is beginning to take the place of the family in many instances. It really is. Things that the family should be providing, government is now providing. We talked about welfare. That's just one of them. What about end-of-life care? Families should be doing that. But instead, now we have people that maybe have chosen not to have kids or families that just believe the government's going to do it, and so let's just ship our parents off and let somebody else take care of them at the end of life. These things are extremely expensive. We know how expensive Medicaid is. We have no idea how expensive Obamacare is going to be, but it's going to be expensive. And so when you start to disconnect the family and what the family traditionally did in terms of providing for its own, and you take those things and place them on government or let government usurp the authority of the family, step in and say, we're going to do this now, all of a sudden the budget balloons. So my argument to those guys that say it needs to be about the fiscal issues, I would say, you know what? If you get the social side of the equation right, I'll give you 10-1 it's going to solve the fiscal side. So for the purposes of our conversation, what is government? Because we talk about government out there as this big amorphous blob, government. Well, at the Montana Family Foundation, we deal with basically government in all forms. We've got the legislature, we've got the courts, increasingly we're having to deal with municipalities. And another thing that a lot of people don't understand is the battle that's going on in the schools right now. All of these are affecting public policy, and they're all affecting who we are as a nation, and they all need to be engaged. So where is the battle? It used to be in the legislature, but I would argue that it's less so now. The legislature, conservatives did a good job, I think, of ramping up and pushing back against government. They've got their people, at least in the Montana legislature. The conservatives control the House to a large degree, to the Senate to a lesser degree. And so, and really, within that whole system we call government, there are choke points. And if you control certain choke points, you don't have to control the whole thing. You can pretty much control the agenda just by controlling two or three choke points within the system. And so we've done a good job at that. And the other side sees this as a battle that's evolving. And there are two distinct worldviews here. You know, there's the smaller government Christian worldview. Not everybody that's a smaller government person is a Christian, obviously. But then we have the large government, you know, worldview out there that we need more government. And those two views are doing this. And that's the way our government's supposed to work. You know, I've always said that, you know, in other countries, they settle public policy questions with bullets in the streets. Here in the United States, we settle those questions in legislative chambers where our only weapons are words. But there has to be a forum for figuring out who we are as a people and making this thing that we call society work for us. So the legislature less so now. The other side has shifted the battle. About 10 years ago, began to shift the battle to the courts. And there were very few judges that were willing to, we throw this term activist judge around. I would say activist judges out there, truly activist judges with a political agenda, willing to use that seat on the bench and push that agenda, maybe 0.2%, maybe. It's not a lot. But if you get those people with that mindset in key judgeships, you can really begin to affect policy in the United States. And so we saw policy in the United States being affected through the courts. And so then we began to engage in the courts. And Pastor Poirier talked about the ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. That's the cadre of Harvard-educated attorneys that we use. We have an in-house attorney, but we also have this pool of attorneys that are experts in certain areas of the law that we can draw on, and they work for us pro bono. And it's a model that has worked well. We began probably a little over 10 years ago now, pushing back hard against groups like the ACLU that were basically winning major court decisions because our side wasn't showing up to the fight. And so now our side shows up, and we're both prepared well. And we, in the ADF, I think they have a win rate somewhere north of 85%. And so this is a good thing. Well, the battlefield is evolving. And so the other side figures, okay, we don't have the legislature, we don't have the courts to the degree that we did, so where's the next battlefield? The next battlefield is the municipalities. And we're seeing that specifically now with regard to anti-discrimination ordinances that are mainly focused on homosexuals and what they call gender identity. And so we saw one that was passed in Missoula. Now, this what it basically says is you can't discriminate against anybody because they're homosexual or for their gender identity. They tried for years to get that in the Montana code, were not successful, and so now they've shifted to do it municipality by municipality. My argument would be that the reason that the people were placed in that section of code to begin with is because they were targeted classes. And this is fresh to me because we just debated this last week in the legislature. The bill came back again. These are targeted classes of people, and so they need extra protection. So we have race, we have gender, religion, those types of things that are already embodied within that section of law. So they want gays, lesbians, transgenders, and anybody that thinks they are. There's a long list that they want put in there as well. Well, we've said no for about 15 years that I know of. And so they're going to the municipalities. And so they went to Missoula and they got one of these put in at the city level, municipal level in Missoula. And then we just had another one that was implemented in Helena. Like I said, this is supposed to be for people that are a targeted class. So we went last week to the Montana Board of Crime Control, pulled the statistics for bias crimes, and we don't have, homosexuals aren't protected in law, in that part of the law. They still have all the protections that you and I have, but there's not an extra degree of protection. And so we pulled the bias crimes report, and we actually track crimes against homosexuals. 2011 was the latest year we had them. There were about 71,000 crimes committed in Montana in that year. One was against somebody because they were homosexual. So I'm not here to say, and hear this clearly, I'm not here to say that people are not targeted because of their sexual orientation. What I am saying is that they are not targeted to a greater degree or to a degree large enough that warrants protection as a targeted class. And another interesting, the Missoula ordinance was put in place about 3 years ago. We checked with the Missoula city attorney the other day. It's never been used once. It's just sitting there, languishing on the books. I would argue that in Montana, basically, we're a live and let live society. But the other side is pushing hard because as they begin to build homosexuality into the code and into the public discussion, it becomes more and more accepted, and then you're going to win bigger and bigger battles as we move forward. So the municipalities are another place. In the Missoula battle, they targeted the city council, got their people elected, and so they knew that they had the majority they needed to pass this on election night, and they just went ahead and did it. The other place is the schools. Interesting. And for those of you that, those of you that have kids in public schools are just deeply involved in the school and what's going on. Because if you're not, you will be shocked. We've been pushing back hard on something called comprehensive sex ed now for about 8 years. And you heard about the big blow-up that they had in Missoula a few years ago, or in Helena a few years ago. They were also targeting Great Falls in Missoula, but we stopped it there. And what this is a curriculum comprehensive. You think this is sex education. That's just a teeny little component. It goes into everything in terms of society and how we view ourselves with relation to, related to family, related to sex, related to health, related to STDs and the whole gamut. And I won't go into detail here, but what I want to say is there's a whole section in there about what a family is. And it is not what you and I think a family is. Basically, it's wide open. And they tell the kids, do you know that families can be all these other things other than a mom and a dad? And we need to be engaged in the schools as well. So where is the battle? The battle is everywhere right now. And there's a lot going on. I mean, society, I would argue that we're almost, those of you that have read the book, The Tipping Point, I think we're just about there. Things are changing fast and could change extremely fast, given the right set of circumstances and the right people elected into the right parts of office. So several areas that we've been involved with over the years that are specific to what we're talking about today in marriage. First, obviously, was the Montana Marriage Amendment. And that was back in 2004. We had a domestic, a DOMA law, basically, on the books that was a Defense of Marriage Act, but we knew that the other side was going to try to get that deemed unconstitutional, so we went to the level of amending the Montana Constitution. The sad thing to me as a former legislator is that language should not be in the Constitution, the Montana Marriage Amendment. That is not constitutional language, sorry to say. What it is, a statutory language shoehorned into the Constitution to stop the court from recognizing same-sex marriage as legal. It's too bad that we had to do that, but that was the only place that we could do it. And remember, this is like a big chessboard. It's the only move we had. And now with three major decisions since then that have been stymied because of that language, I think it was probably the right thing to do, but it still grieves me that we put language like that in our Constitution. During the marriage debate at the UM Law School, it was the very end of this debate. I traveled the whole state debating the issue with my friend Carl Olson, who's the head of the Montana Gay and Lesbian Association. And our last debate was the week before the election. It was held in Missoula, Montana, of all places, at the University of Montana Law School, and it was sponsored by the ACLU. And, yeah, you know, I like speaking to people with whom I agree, you know, back to that. But anyway, so it was a great debate, though. Great give and take. The audience was kind. We went on for 2.5 hours. And I kept bringing him back around to this point. How many people constitute a marriage, Carl? And he wouldn't answer it. He would just go off, you know, and he wouldn't answer it. So finally, the third time, I said to the crowd, I said, okay, stop. I said, I'm going to do this one more time. I want you to notice what's going on here. I am going to ask my opponent, how many people constitute a marriage? And we'll watch him wiggle and squirm for the third time. Carl, how many people should constitute a marriage? Well, Jeff, I really don't think that's the issue here. The crowd bursts out in laughter. I mean, but that's where they're going at. Marriage, they want marriage to mean everything to everybody. And when you do that, it winds up meaning nothing to everybody. This is an institution that we need to fight for. The other thing that we've got right now up is a parental consent for abortion measure. LR 120 that was on the ballot last time was parental notification for a minor seeking an abortion. And when we were in the middle of that debate at the legislature to get that referendum passed, the other side kept saying, this is unconstitutional. This has been deemed unconstitutional. You can't do this. And what we argued was there are two cases basically that control this. There's the Armstrong case that deals with privacy in Montana. And then they coupled the Armstrong case with a Wicklund. There's two Wicklund cases. They coupled that with the state-level Wicklund case, where the court coupled Armstrong with Article 2, Section 15 of the Montana Constitution, which is the rights of minors provision, and they said that the right of privacy now extends all the way down for minors with no low-end threshold. So when this concept plays itself out, suddenly you have a minor child, a girl, that at whatever age she can get pregnant, she can be taken by someone else other than her parents for an abortion. Is that constitutional? Well, the lower court, it was never appealed to the Supreme Court. The lower court said, district court said it was constitutional. And so we said, well, certainly there's got to be a low-end threshold. Let's go back and have the court revisit this. And so we did with LR 120. The people passed it by 71%. And so we brought this up. Now what we want to do is we want to make it consent for a minor to get an abortion rather than just notification. And that comports with three of the surrounding states. Idaho and Wyoming both require the consent of one parent. North Dakota requires the consent of both parents. And so so we had these arguments again last week, and I brought that up, and I kind of laid out a train of thought. And then suddenly, and some of you may have seen, it was misquoted in all the papers around the entire state where I said basically that the voters should be able to ignore the Constitution because the people should never be subservient to their own Constitution. That's not what I said. What I said was the district court deemed parental notification unconstitutional. The people said through a direct vote of the people that they wanted parental notification by a margin of 71%. So there's a disconnect between the court's interpretation of the Constitution and the will of the people. So I said one of two things need to happen. Either the court got it right and the people need to amend their Constitution to comport with their will, or the court overreached and the court needs to revisit the case and maybe say, okay, in light of the vote, maybe we shouldn't have kids all the way down to 11 or whenever a girl can get pregnant allowed to get an abortion without their parents knowing about it. But I said either way, the people should not be held subservient to their own constitution. That was the entire context. So anyway, we're having to fight these constitutional arguments on a case-by-case basis, and it's a challenge. The other thing is, okay, so that's at the ballot box. When we talk about welfare coming through the legislature, we need to remember that welfare is a double-edged sword. Welfare harms the people that are on it because it's a disincentive to them working. People could be on welfare for short term. I mean, we need to take care of people that are down and out. But you should not have five generations on welfare. This is not a lifestyle. We need to help people that need help short term. It's a two-edged sword, though, because it's a disincentive that removes work ethics from families. It makes families basically gives them a poverty mindset, so it cuts that way. The other way it cuts is it cuts against the taxpayers who actually have to pay for this. So it's damaging society in two ways. Next, when we get back to the courts right now, we've got, so we've dealt with the ballot box, which is one place we fight the fight. We've dealt with the legislature, which is another place. Now we're going to deal with the courts. And specifically on same-sex marriage, that's a big part of what we find ourselves working on right now. Recently, we had the Donaldson decision at the state, and that's where six same-sex couples basically asked the court to order the legislature to proactively grant all the benefits of marriage to same-sex couples. First of all, you can't do this. This is a separation of powers issue. The court can't tell the legislature what to do. As a former legislator, when I read that, something rose up in me and said, you can't do that. But anyway, they tried it, and four of the seven justices said, no, this is an overreach. You can't do this. Justice Nelson, ironically, though, and Justice Nelson, I'll say it publicly, I consider Justice Nelson an activist judge, and I think he let us know that in this decision. Justice Nelson wrote a 109-page dissent on this, and he was mad. And he's since retired, and this was kind of his last big decision that he was going to write on. And so he wrote several things in there that were disturbing to me, one of which was the fact that he said as societies evolve, we have less and less need for myths like religion. I mean, that burned me a little bit there. Anyway, but one of the things he said was, it grieves me, and this is a paraphrase, this isn't a quote, but it grieves me that the work that we began with Grison 15 years ago, and Grison was the first decision, the first decision on homosexuality, really, it did away with Montana sodomy law. He said, it grieves me that the work that we began with Grison was not completed with Donaldson. That's an agenda. Legislatures get to have agendas. Courts don't get to have agendas. So anyway, the other thing that we've had recently was the federal district court in Hawaii was asked to rule on Hawaii's same-sex marriage law, and oh, the judge got it right. He said, first of all, same-sex couples do not have the right to marry, and one of the reasons that he gave was he says, if we go down that road, we risk decoupling marriage and procreation. Finally, someone's looking at this from the right perspective, because if we decouple marriage from procreation, and marriage just becomes this institution where people that love each other, love, like, whatever, have an emotional attachment, but maybe don't plan to have kids or what have you, we risk decoupling this generation from the next generation. We relate generationally through our kids. One of the reasons I get up and go to work in the morning, A, is to support my wife, but B, to support my kids and to raise them up so that they can go off and lead healthy and productive lives. And if we don't have that generation or that generational mentality, then what do? You spend their money like we're doing at the federal level right now. You spend them into debt because this is about the me generation, my generation. I want what I want. And you forget that there's an entire generation coming behind us that we're responsible for. So we cannot decouple marriage and procreation. Not all couples have kids, but that's a major reason for marriage, and we have to keep that first and foremost. Okay, we talked about the municipalities and those municipal ordinances that are coming through, and we talked about comprehensive sex ed that's going through the schools and how that, within the context of that, curriculum redefines families and is teaching that to kids, beginning ironically in kindergarten. Seriously. And if you look in the curriculum, it starts, there's a whole column, and this is what we teach in kindergarten under sex ed. And then this is what we teach, you know, in succeeding grades. So the other thing that we are not directly involved with, but somebody needs to take on this fight, is in the media. Media is completely redefining what families look like, you know, modern family that's out there and things like that. When is the last time somebody saw a TV show that showed just a normal family with a dad that was not an idiot? Really and truly. I mean, fathers are portrayed as just bumbling fools in the media now. Okay. So we've got the battle. The question is, And I want to leave you with something to go with right now. So we've got this battle. Who should be involved? Well, I believe that it should be, first and foremost, it should be the church. We have a vested interest in this. God showed us what marriage is supposed to look like. Marco Rubio. So God showed us what marriage is supposed to look like. We're supposed to be the light to the world. And so we need to go out and we need to show what healthy marriages look like. The problem is the church is as dysfunctional as the entire rest of society, statistically. All the ills that tie to marriage that exist in society exist in the church at almost the same levels that they do in the general population. Guys, we are not doing a good job of this. And I have friends that are gay and lesbian that say, you don't want same-sex marriage. You guys aren't doing very good with homosexual or heterosexual marriage either. And you know what? They're right. I admit it. So we have got to get our game together first before we start going out and telling the rest of the world the way that, you know, how they need to lead their lives. When we look at what's going on in Helena, the church should be there. Who do we have in Helena right now? It's not the church. Let me tell you that. They are not there. There's very few of us that are engaged in that. I'll tell you who is involved from the church's perspective are the liberal churches. They're up there in mass. They're filing amicus briefs on court cases. I think it's the Montana Council of Churches. It may be the Montana Association of Churches. Anyway, basically made up of liberal churches, and these guys have a theology that I don't even really recognize in the Bible. And they say it's okay to have same-sex marriage. It's, you know, whatever you want to do. Abortion is okay. I mean, all that stuff's just fine. And they're up there on the Donaldson case. I was reading the amicus briefs as they came in, and here's one from Montana church leaders. I thought, well, this is interesting. I start reading it, and it's all of the most liberal of the liberal churches saying the court has got to rule in the affirmative on Donaldson. Well, we can't, for Pete's sake, we're going to let these guys speak on behalf of all Christendom? So we ran out, and we got almost 350 churches, if you throw in all the Catholics, to do an amicus brief on the other side and say, listen, wait a minute, not all churches see this issue the same way. But liberal churches are engaged. The gay community is engaged to a large degree. There are probably three or four more times the gay lobbyists that are up there than are evangelical Christian lobbyists. And that's by design. Guys like Tim Gill, who used to own Quirk, they're pouring a lot of money into putting their agenda, first of all, into getting people that they want elected, but then also pushing their agenda through the legislature once the legislature convenes. So we have a lot of folks that are gay that are up there. We also have, ironically, kids of Christians. You know, we think we're bringing up our kids and training them up in the way that they should go. Oh, man, it's sad. We have one legislator up there professing born-again Christians. One Southern Baptist, one Foursquare. Not exactly what you'd call liberal denominations. That we can't get a vote out of. On abortion, on gay rights, on anything, they always go with the other side. I just found out the other day that Planned Parenthood has a brand new lobbyist in training that's up there. Assemblies of God. She's working for Planned Parenthood. What is going on here, people? So we need to make sure that our kids are grounded. And then we have legislators just flat don't have a Christian worldview. But that's always been the case. And so we just have to, you know, it's our job to educate people. And, you know, God's rules may be his rules for the church, but there's a real good reason always behind them. And God doesn't care if we ask why. He encourages us. Let's find out who he is and why he thinks the way he does. And if he says marriage should be between a man and a woman, there's a good reason for it. I mean, I may be really one of those simple guys, but if God says that, I'm going to do it. And go back many times and say, why, Lord, and search it out and get to know his heart. But I start with the premise that if he said it, it's true, and I should do it. And that may be oversimplified for a lot of people, but it works for me. The other thing that the church needs to know is that the other side is coming after the church. They are not going to. You may just want to sit down in a foxhole and think, okay, we'll be safe here. You won't. They're coming after you. And I don't mean to be alarmist, but it's true. In the last few years, we've killed bills in the legislature that would have forced pastors to become state-licensed counselors if they wanted to do marriage counseling. We killed a bill last session that would have forced churches to pay property taxes. We killed another bill that would have dictated what pastors can preach and what parts of the Bible they can preach out of. And then we killed one just yesterday that would have forced all Christian youth treatment centers to become licensed and adhere to state standards, even if they accept no public dollars. So they're just not going to let you just stay, you know, in your little foxhole and be safe here. They're coming after you. And so, as I said, I believe that we're at a tipping point. Marriage is the linchpin. And I think that you're hearing that today. Marriage is the linchpin. It's what holds all of it together. It's the smallest unit of society. And if we don't get it right, then the next generation doesn't have the tools that they need to go on and run a society. It's almost a fiduciary responsibility. I know it's a financial term, but really and truly, we have a responsibility to the next generation to raise them up in such a manner that they can continue on with the society and the groundwork that we've laid. Do you know what Thomas Jefferson said the purpose of an education is? Not to get a good job. He said the purpose of an education is to create a citizenry intelligent enough to maintain its freedom. Wow. Puts a whole new spin on education. Thomas Jefferson said that the purpose of an education is to create a citizenry intelligent enough to maintain its freedom. Yeah. So as I said, we're at a tipping point, and we could sure use your help. If there's any of you that you know that want to engage at whatever level, I'm not saying that everybody in this room should run for the legislature, although I hope that some of you would consider that. There's a fight that's going on up there, and we have term limits, and we have good guys like Ken Miller and like Tom McGillivray, that got term limited out of office, kicked out of office, basically, at the will of the people. We decided we wanted fresh blood circulating through. The challenge is when you kick a good person out of office, there needs to be somebody there to replace them. Dan McGee, another stalwart for the family. And so we need to continually have this new generation of legislators coming up that can carry on and fight the fight. So working in the legislature would be part of it, but when we talk from a public policy perspective, there's lots of other places that you could get involved. You could get involved on the school board. That is a thankless job, but it's such an important job. That's another place you could get involved in. You could run for the city council, another thankless job. But we see now that they're pushing a social agenda through the city council. On the school boards, we just got a document the other day that was handed out to a committee that we were arguing a bill in, and it said the goals for Montana education in the coming decade. You know what one of the goals was? Teach more social values. Whose social values? Really and truly. I mean, they want to get more and more into the area of social values. So at the very least, I hope you guys are voting. And we could use people. Tanya came up and testified at a hearing that we had the other day. Many of you have come up and been involved at the legislative level. You can either come up and testify on the bills because they need to see real people, not just lobbyists in front of them all the time. They need to see real people. You can, if you would, we've got sign-up sheets. Give us your email address. We'll send you our legislative alerts out. At the very least, if you could send a quick email off to a legislator that says, please vote for this bill, I think it's a good idea, that would be that's a pretty low threshold to get involved. But we need people like that, too. It makes a difference when all of a sudden legislators, we had one recently that we targeted. Two legislators, one of them stood up on the floor of the House, got 700 emails in 4 hours because we said we have got to win this vote. He held up this stack of emails and said, I have 700 emails on my desk. What about this? Don't we understand? They want this bill. And he voted for it, and the bill, he voted against it, actually, and the bill died, which was a good thing. So anyway, so that's all I have to say. I hope that you're here because you're engaged. I mean, literally, preaching to the choir, that's what I'm doing right here.
Do you have a question or two for...
Recently, our Attorney General, Eric Holder, was quoted as saying that the U.S. Constitution the U.S. Constitution does not speak about education, and therefore it would be within the federal government's authority to ban homeschooling. He took it to that next step.
Well, I guess I'd go back to the 10th Amendment and say, you know, granted it doesn't say anything, but the 10th Amendment says that the powers not directly granted to the federal government are reserved to the states and to the people. So if it's not talking about it, I don't think it's your power, Mr. Attorney General. That's just how I would interpret it, and I'm not an attorney. So what do I have to say?
That's the